You're listening to the Popmatic. Let me start over. You're listening to the Popmatic podcast for June 18th, 2014. We're going to do some heavy lifting on this show.
Because we're so super strong.
Ample noise.
Popmatic podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. I'm Brian, and joining me today are
Bill,
Amanda,
Greg, but my full name is Gregoire Dostoevsky.
Mike,
Crystal.
So June 21st is the solstice, and you know that's the longest day of the year. So we're going to tell you about the longest books, movies, and music. Do you have what it takes? You know,
get comfy.
You know that Arnold Schwarzenegger and his weightlifting buddies would go out into the German forest and they would just lift logs and stones and then they would just roast chickens over an open fire. Do you have that kind of dedication?
Nope.
Generally not.
But even okay, listen, here's some motivation. Think of all the summer challenge points you can get if you dig into these items. Okay, we're going to tell you about the long ones, at least the ones that are worth your time.
Since the topic is long, my choice is The Wolf of Wall Street, directed by Martin Scorsese, coming in at 180 minutes.
That's a lot.
And while, yes, it is. But while watching it, the thing is, I didn't even realize the movie was that long. It just flew by. Unlike Beast of the Southern Wild, which is only 93 minutes long, but I felt I was in the theater for 180 minutes.
I love that movie. Just saying.
I had to agree with Bill on this one.
In brief, The Wolf of Wall Street is based on the life of Jordan Belfort, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, in which he witnessed the rise and fall of a stockbroker. You get to witness the high life and the fall by his own doing. When it was released, The Wolf of Wall Street was highly criticized because they celebrated, I guess the word would be, a deviant lifestyle. I mean, these characters have no true moral compass whatsoever. But if you look at Martin Scorsese's other two epics, Goodfellas comes in at 146 minutes, and Casino, which comes in at 178 minutes, they all deal with the quest of money and power. I kind of call them hedonistic thrill rides. Gangsters in Wall Street, there's not much difference there nowadays. They all deal with the American dream on some sort of strange acid trip. At the end of the films, the characters are strangely unrepentant. In Goodfellas, the Ray Liotta, the character that Ray Liotta plays, Henry Hill, he's gone into a witness protection program, and he despises what he calls a suburban schlub. He misses the days when he was a movie star with muscle. I highly recommend all three movies. Even though they're all long, they move like a bullet train. And I saw them at the theater, and they're kind of like favorite cable movies. When they're on, I have to sit down and watch them again, even though I own them on DVD. They're that good. Anyway, the main movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, extremely dark comedy. It has some of the funniest scenes in American film in years. Highly recommend them. Wolf on Wall Street, Casino, and Goodfellas. One brief thing before I go, since we're speaking of long, this is a little before time, but keep your calendars marked for August 30th through 31st. They're going to be showing David Lean's Dr. Zhivago, all 197 minutes of it. You ought to see this movie on a big screen. It's a big screen movie.
Absolutely.
You should go the Belcourt to or? At the Belcourt. Okay. And August 30th, 31st, I'm going on my birthday. I'm giving myself a birthday gift. So highly recommend that. Keep that date in mind.
And it's just like Klaus Kinski has the best little cameo in the movie when he says, "I'm the only free man here. The rest of you are cattle." My favorite Klaus Kinski moments.
I want to see the cable edit of Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
That could be hilarious. It would only be like 20 minutes long.
Oh, it set a record, too, for R-rated movies. The most F-word used in a movie.
So, Crystal, you were laughing about something. What were you laughing about?
It's Ray Liotta instead of Ray Lolita.
Oh, yeah. I didn't catch that.
He has literary Tourette's.
That's right.
I get so excited when I talk about these.
Ray Liotta.
Ray Liotta.
I just thought you were thinking about deviant lifestyles. Mm-hmm. It was a Freudian slip. So, Amanda, what's happening with you this solstice?
Well, guten Tag, my Kinder, and willkommen. Today we are going to talk about Darin des Nibelungen.
Okay, that's all the German that I know. You can't talk about long things without talking about Richard Wagner's The Ring Cycle. This is a collection of four operas, and he really called it a Bühnenfestspiel, or a stage festival play, because it takes 4 days to perform this whole work in its entirety. And it's actually about 15 hours worth of big German opera. This Ring Cycle took Wagner 26 years to write, and he did both the music and the libretto, and it's based on characters from Norse and German legend, like Odin and the Valkyries and Valhalla and Siegfried. So the four operas, we have all four operas here at Nashville. They're not under the Ring Cycle, they're under their individual titles, so pay attention, get ready to write these down. The first one is Das Rheingold, and it's the shortest. It clocks in at about 2.5 hours, so maybe you should start there. Then we have Die Walküre, which is the Valkyries, which is the music everybody knows forever. Then Siegfried, and then the last one is Götterdämmerung, or The Twilight of the Gods, and that one clocks in at just over 5 hours long, excluding intermissions. I hope you get a good seat for that one, because you're going to be in it for a while. So the plot for this whole cycle basically revolves around a magic ring that grants the power to rule the world. Where have we heard that before? Forged by a dwarf, and that he stole the gold from the Rhine maidens in the Rhine River, and then festivities ensue, and people steal it, and they fight over it, and they sacrifice themselves for it. And so that's basically the premise of the whole entire Ring Cycle, is what happens to this ring as it wanders around. I can't say it's the first really large opera, because there were several others, but Wagner kind of took opera to a whole new level. This production was so large that he actually wanted to design a theater just to be able, because theaters in that day could not handle these productions because the orchestra was too big, and he always had all these new big brass instruments and saxophones that hadn't really been used before in opera. So in 1871, he picked out a Bavarian town called Bayreuth, and then fought for 2 years to try to get enough capital to build this theater that he had designed. And finally, King Ludwig got sick of him bugging him, so he just said, here, have your money. And so they built the Bayreuth Festspielhaus, and it's still there today. They still have the Bayreuth Festival every year. It opened in 1876, and the first complete performance of The Ring took place that August, from the 13th to the 17th. The theater also had to have really strong acoustics, because these pieces for singers with such a large orchestra, the singer gets really hard to hear, and so they had to have really good stage acoustics so you could hear the singers over the orchestra without stressing the singer's voice, so they could sing for 15 hours. So this was really a momentous, huge building that he had to design. Bayreuth has become, if you're any kind of Wagner enthusiast, which I can't really claim to be, so this is not on my radar to go, but you can go every year. They put on the Ring Cycle in full. They also do other Wagner operas. If you do want to go, you better get your tickets now, because it takes years once you're on the wait list to get them. They're kind of like season tickets to
I'll get us games. Press passes.
Okay, Brian will get us in.
All right.
Everybody.
The library can fly us to Bayreuth.
And we
can
go to house Bayreuth.
Bayreuth, yes. So 15 hours is a long time, and I don't know if I have 15 hours. However, Chuck Jones in 1957 saved the day. He put out a 7-minute cartoon called What's Opera Doc, which I have since referred to as Kill the Wabbit, that basically takes the whole entire Ring Cycle and condenses it down to 7 minutes with Elmer chasing Bugs. Bugs is the love interest, Brunhilde. It does kind of spoof a little bit Disney's Fantasia as well, with like the set design and that kind of thing. But if you have not seen Kill the Wabbit, you need to. I'll have Brian put a link to it in the show notes. You can watch it online. And when I was watching it, they also had a little short about how the making of What's Opera Doc, called Wagnerian Wabbit. I don't know if you say Wagnerian Wabbit. But anyway, so I'll have him put that link. That was also interesting. They were talking about how they were voicing it and how they chose to actually sing well with accents, and it was really interesting as well. So that is Kill the Wabbit. And the last, we can't talk about The Ring without talking about The Precious. Tolkien spent a lot of time defending the fact that he did not steal this from his precious from Wagner's ring. I do think that there is some linkage. I think he went back farther to the original Norse legends that Wagner, so they both use the same source material. Because there is the crucial element of the fact that the ring is evil and it gets stolen and wrecks lives and saves lives and does
plus, Tolkien had more rings, so that's better.
Right? Yeah, so see, more is always better. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to introduce a new benchmark into the measuring of length and longness. So Hollywood is currently making The Hobbit, which is the prequel to The Lord of the Rings. They're making three about three-hour movies, so that gets about 9 hours worth of movie. The book is only 400 pages long. So I think that we should have a race, and somebody should start reading the book at the same time someone starts watching the movies, and then we'll measure how fast you can actually read the book versus watching the movies, because I have a feeling, and I would put myself in on this, that you can read the book faster than you can watch all of the new Hobbit movies.
I'm sure, yeah.
Maybe that's a little bit too long, Hollywood. I'm just saying.
But yeah, I think you're totally right, because I think with Lord of the Rings, it was a major accomplishment. And then The Hobbit is a travesty.
Well, the Lord of the Rings is three actual books. I mean, it's not one book that they made three movies out of. So, because I don't think you could read the Lord of the Rings faster than you could watch the movies, but I definitely think I could read The Hobbit faster. Oh, so
man. I take so many like nap breaks. Reading it, Lord of the Rings.
Caffeine up first.
Yeah.
If you read The Lord of the Rings, it's not exactly like action-packed every chapter.
Nope.
That's true. Yeah.
Nope. Then they walked in the woods. Yeah. Some more.
That's what they cast in The Hobbit. They're like, oh, look, they're walking in the woods. Where's Arnold with his weightlifting buddies? I don't see them. Okay, Mr. Mike, what's long in your world?
This one was tricky for me because I don't really like long things. It's really to the point now where like I see a video on YouTube and it's like, if it's longer than like 2 minutes, I'm out. You know, I tried to think of something that was like huge and long and that I really liked. And there are a few things that came to mind, but I think the one that I can get really enthused about is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly from 1966, directed by Sergio Leone, or however you pronounce it. And I really love this movie. Like they did a revival at the Belcourt of the Complete Dollars trilogy a couple of years ago. It was amazing. Like, I, like, walked out of the theater. I was like, like, light and walking on air and stuff. And then for some reason, I decided to go see G.I. Joe. And then I went back to, you know, after seeing G.I. Joe, I went back to my normal level of, you know, mild depression and hating life.
We always plug the Belcourt on here, but I've had that experience so many times where the amount that you pay to get into a commercial theater is, like, inversely proportional to the amount of pleasure you will have.
Oh, yes.
Where if you go to the Belcourt, it's the same, except you only pay a little, and the pleasure you get is, like, amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I just had that experience the other day with Sorcerer.
Ooh. What was the other movie you saw? Did you see another movie right afterwards?
No, but, I mean, I just, like, it was Sorcerer was the movie that you're not going to see anywhere.
Yeah.
And I had it at the Belcourt for, I think, one night, two nights, a weekend, and it was, like,
fantastic.
Fantastic. Yeah. You know,
if we show it in September, it's going to be better here.
I am particularly mentioning that particular movie because we are going to show that here at the library.
Of course. Uh-huh. Of course.
And we have an interview with Bud Smith, the film editor. I'm sorry, continue.
How much does that one cost?
That one at the library, totally free.
What? Ooh,
that's
free.
Maximum investment on.
I would pay double that.
Wow. Okay. Viva la Biblioteca. And, where am I? Oh, right. So basically, the story is about the three thieves in search of buried treasure in the Old West during the Civil War. Basically, the main character is the Ugly, who's Lee Wallach as Tuco. I read some books on spaghetti westerns, and he basically kind of follows the archetype of he's basically like the average Italian person, or what Italian filmmakers viewed their public. So he's like kind of a goofball, not particularly bright, but you know. Or he's, like, very clever, but, like, you know, like, but not in, like, a book smart kind of way. Clint Eastwood plays Blondie. Fun fact, the Man with No Name trilogy, he actually does have a name in each movie, but they're really lame. So, like, you know, we don't really talk about him much. But he's like a cipher. You don't really get to know him that well. And the bad guy is Lee Van Cleef, who plays Angel Eyes. He's, like, all sadistic and stuff. And, yeah, he's barely in the movie, though. So, you know, it's, like, the ugly, the good, and, oh, yeah, there's a bad guy in there somewhere. There's this huge epic Civil War battle scene that's pretty cool that, like, with cannons going off and bridges being demolished. And that's pretty cool towards the end. That was, like, one of the most expensive things, if I recall correctly, in European cinema at the time. That has really little to do with the plot. They have to, like, go across the bridge before it blows up. at the very end, there's a three-way duel between the three of them, which is really cool because they Leone focuses on their eyes exclusively. So you get to see, like, you know, do I shoot that guy? Do I shoot this guy? Do I shoot this guy? Do I shoot that guy? And it's really, like, you know, intense even now, even though I know who's going to get shot. Also, I thought that, you know, off the top of my head, I would mention a long book that I liked. The longest book I read recently that I liked was it the Count of Monte Cristo, the original one, uncut, which is like over 1,000 pages. I mean, there were bits that were kind of meh, but overall, I thought like their whole revenge arc was really cool. You know, when he like busts out of prison, Edward Dantes busts out of prison and gets revenge on the people who put him in there. You know, you get to really feel for the guy because he gets in there for basically no reason and he's like stuck in prison for life. The revenge bits are really cool because it'll be all like, you know, who are you? Why are you, you know, messing with me? I'm Edward Dantes. And then like, you know, it's a 19th century Jaws drop on the floor. No, no. Downside is that there's like a huge like 400 page like interlude in the middle with this love story between this like, you know, kid of one of the kid, you know, the two people he wants to get revenge on that I wasn't a huge fan of. But other than that bit.
I just want to read that part.
Of course you do. That's where, you know, if I abridged, you know, the abridged version may be better, but I don't know. Anyway, yeah, so the man, there, the, I want to say the man in the Iron Mask, which I have not read, but the Count of Monte Cristo and the Good, Bad, the Ugly. Yeah, so I think it's Greg.
Yeah. Yeah. When is Tarantino making his version of Monte Cristo?
Well, that'd be cool.
That's not real.
I wish.
Okay, so a lot of people are getting back from Bonnaroo this week. And while you may have seen and heard some great music, one performance that everybody is sure to be talking about is the Flaming Lips. They become something of a staple there, and their performances are so over the top that they become somewhat legendary. In 2007, lead singer Wayne Coyne landed on stage in a UFO, and yes. Cool. And,
a real UFO?
I think it was a real, you know.
Probing option.
That's an inclusive term, UFO. So, it, you know.
Unidentified flying object, so it could be.
It could be anything. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was classic USO UFO shape, though.
Oh, flying saucer, you mean?
Saucer. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, there's a difference.
any sci-fi nerds in the house? And he routinely closes the show by crowd surfing inside a giant inflatable ball. If you've ever seen that, it's pretty awesome. I went to Bonnaroo one time. One little indiscretion in my youth. It was pretty awesome. It works way better than traditional crowd surfing.
You don't get groped, for one thing.
You bounce if they drop you.
Yeah. Okay, so well, not surprisingly, these sorts of hijinks extend to the recording career as well. Fans may remember back on Halloween of 2011 when they premiered a 24-hour song called Seven Skies H3. That's right, a 24-hour song, in case you missed that. The song is still streamable in its entirety on flaminglips24hoursong.com. But until now, if you wanted to own it, it was only available through the all-too-precarious medium of a hard drive encased inside of an actual human skull topped with chrome drips. Whoa, so there were only 13 of them made, and I hear they sold for $5,000 a piece.
What a good investment.
I need to get a loan from the bank. I'll see you guys.
Let's just appreciate, too, from what I hear. But this year, for Record Store Day, they released a vinyl edit which features a mere 43-minute version of the song, or as the band described it, an extraction. And this is also available for download, too, from Hoopla, kind of randomly. But I do recommend you go back and listen to the original material in installments if you have to. As Wayne says, it's a long time to sit down and listen to a song, but it's not such a long time to live your life. So I think what he was referring to is that this is sort of the way that people listen to music nowadays anyway, by sort of putting it on in the background while doing something else. So Seven Skies H3 itself is pretty atmospheric, and it has sort of a Halloween meets 2001 Space Odyssey feel to it. So suffice it to say, I wouldn't recommend listening to it at work, but definitely give it a shot.
All right, so I'm going to take this back to books. There have been many stories.
Wait, you just said I'm going to take this back to books, and Bill audibly sighed.
Oh, man. Okay. I'm going to take a nap.
A 20-hour opera.
So there have been many stories written about vampires and witches. One might think one couldn't possibly read another. At least that's what I was thinking back in 2011 when I picked up Deborah Harkness's A Discovery of Witches. But as I began to read it, all 579 pages, I thoroughly enjoyed myself. Then book 2, Shadow of Night, came out in the summer of 2012, furthering the saga another 581 pages. And on July 15th, what's come to be known as the All Souls Trilogy concludes with The Book of Life, reportedly clocking in at 576 pages. So that's 579 plus 581 plus 576. That's a lot of pages. So what's it all about, you ask? Come on.
Is it witches?
Somebody.
What's that all about?
Do witches get discovered?
Yeah. To give you the broad strokes, the All Souls trilogy follows the story of Diana Bishop, a historian and reluctant witch, as she solves the mystery of an ancient manuscript, falls in love with a mysterious vampire, and learns how to love and accept her true nature. So I'm going to go back and give you a few more details. Diana is conducting research at Oxford, and she accidentally calls out a powerful long-lost manuscript known as Ashmole 782. The witch powers she's tried so hard to forget also awaken, and that attracts the unwanted attention of other powerful magical beings, like vampire Matthew Clermont, the yoga-practicing, wine-drinking geneticist, who is also obsessed with Darwin. So Diana and Matthew, witch and vampire, scholar and physician, join forces to keep Ashmole 782 out of the hands of the bad guys. Along the way, they fall passionately in love. But Harkness doesn't leave it at that. Being a true scholar and researcher herself, she uses the adventures of her characters to weave in tons of incredible historical detail. So much so that she tricked me into reading this trilogy, which is only a little bit fantasy, a little bit romance, and a whole lot history. The trilogy is available in print, CD audio, Playaway, and ebook. So again, you have until July 15th to consume the first two volumes. But also, in the meantime, do check out her website. On the FAQs page, someone asks the important question, where did the inspiration of a vampire that does yoga come from? Harkness says, I was in yoga class trying to do down dog, and while upside down, I spotted someone who seemed to be balancing on a bit of their forearm and their ear. Obviously, that person was not human.
And they take yoga classes at night.
As long as they're not sparkly vampires, I'm good.
Yeah.
No sparkling here.
No sparkling. Okay.
All right, Brian, what you got to close out this long podcast?
I'm going back to the Black Forest.
Ooh.
It's funny because my Schwarzenegger joke at the beginning, I didn't even know that we were going to talk about two German composers, but I wanted to talk about Gustav Mahler symphonies. Gustav Mahler symphonies are known for being super long. His symphony number 8 is called the Symphony of 1,000 because that's, it's a lot of people to perform the symphony. Gustav Mahler is usually considered the bridge between 19th century romanticism and 20th century music. He innovated the use of brass in symphonies. It seems like, too, Gian Guerrero, the conductor of the Nashville Symphony Orchestra, he seems to be a Mahler head, too. Every year he seems to do one of his symphonies. And Amanda, did you sing in one of the symphonies?
I did the Symphony 8.
Yeah.
Give us a little bit right now.
I love it. I love it.
Transcend.
So Mahler's Symphony number 2 and Symphony number 8 are extremely long. But I'm going to talk about Mahler's Symphony number 6, which typically comes in at around 80 minutes. I mean, that's not bad. Now, I first heard this symphony on the radio when I was in college. So here's what I heard. George Zell conducting the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra. And, I first heard that. That just really blew my mind. So I was in college when I first heard that. So it was funny. I went to my college library, and they had all of these George Zell conducting the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra recordings on vinyl. And it was great because the vinyl was pristine, and I would just hang out at the college library and listen. Got me to love Gustav Mahler. And I got a lot of homework done, too. Now, and also, some of my happiest memories, I live up around Lake Erie, and I would just walk around with like a big parka with the, you know, with the hood, like all Kenny from South Park style, and my headphones under my hood, like listening to Gustav Mahler in the snow. It's like some of the happiest, pleasant memories in my life. Even though his music, I think it, for me, it's very tragic and sad. The Sixth Symphony is actually usually referred to as the tragic, but I only like sad music, so it worked out really well for me. There's been enough European art music on the show already, so just to bring it back to maybe pop culture land, Jim Jarmusch's movie Coffee and Cigarettes is all these little vignettes of pop stars and quirky people talking about their life. And your mileage may vary on this movie. It's kind of like a collection of short stories. You know, you're going to like some of the interactions better than others, but Bill Murray is in it, and RZA is in it, and Jack White is in it. But the very last sequence are these two, like, down-and-out dudes, like janitors in a break room, and the one guy is talking about this Mahler's art song, I Am Lost to the World, and I'm going to try the German, and you can make fun of me, Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen, and... Crystal's laughing. Crystal's laughing.
Crystal's our German scholar.
Yeah.
So the English translation is "I am lost to the world," and the one guy's talking about how beautiful the song is, and it slowly fades in. The mezzo soprano on the song that they use in the movie is Janet Baker, and we have the very best of Janet Baker with that one song on it. We have that on Hoopla, and we have it on CD.
Who wrote that? That wasn't... Mahler didn't write that poem, though, did he?
Mahler did not write that poem.
I'm trying to think, because that was the art... That was the song I did my artwork on that we did.
It was Rückart.
I couldn't have told you that.
Yes.
I just remember I'm Lost in the World. That was the whole premise.
So the two... It was the same guy's poems are the basis of the two really famous Mahler song cycles. So I think the one is just called, like, the Rückart song cycle. And then the one is the Kindertoten.
As the Kindertotenladen.
Yeah.
Brian, if I may further connect Mahler to pop culture, he was kind of like the it composer in the 60s a little bit. And so he was a big influence on the Beatles. Paul is reported to have said this, but also John Lennon's glasses, like his signature glasses that he's known to wear in sort of the late 60s, were kind of copped from Mahler's look. And like, pull up his picture of Mahler, pull up a picture of Lennon. See what I'm talking about.
Totally. So what I love about this scene is to hear these two, like, down-and-out dudes, but they're talking about, like, this European art music. And I always like that, too, because, you know, I don't think that classical music, quote-unquote classical music or European art music is, like, better than other music or, like, real music and other music is not real music. But I think it's cool that someone like me could just love to appreciate this music through the radio and through their library. And I like that the two guys in Coffee and Cigarettes are these two working class guys talking about how beautiful this song is.
Tickling my fancy this week is Jack White's new album, Lazaretto, available for download from Freegal. Forget about the controversy surrounding his feud with Black Keys' Dan Auerbach. Lazaretto is a great rock record, I'm telling you people. And the album cover features weeping angels. At least, that's what they look like to me. You can make your own assessment. By the way, you can also stream the Black Keys' new album, Turn Blue, on Hoopla. And that's with your library card.
Speaking of things you could find in the magic of Hoopla, I was thinking of recommending a movie that I watched this very weekend called District B-13, a action film from France directed by Luc Besson, director of such films as Leon the Professional. So basically it's set in the future, where the ghettos of Paris have been walled off from the rest of the city. And it's this crime lord steals a nuclear device that the minute he opens the case, it becomes armed for like the next, you know, it's going to blow up in 24 hours. And it's supposed to be like a super neutron bomb where, like, you know, all the people will be vaporized, but the real estate will be fine. This cop and a thief team up to take the bomb and save the bad area of Paris. What's neat is that the thief is played by David Bell, who's one of the founders of parkour. So there's a lot of parkour scenes where he's, like, you know, jumping up buildings and falling down buildings and jumping up staircases and all that kind of thing. And the fight scenes are really cool. It's pretty funny. It's a good movie. Yeah. And I also like that one of the henchmen is named K2 and he's got it, like, shaved in the back of his head. So, like, you know, I wonder which one's K2. The downside is that I watched it on Amazon Instant, and they only had the dubbed version. The dubbing, it's so bad. It's like if I tried to dub something where I talk really fast and kind of mumble.
So I'll be like,
can we can get a little bit of that?
Hey guys, how's it going? Yeah. Bonjour.
We need the image for
that. Yeah, I guess you'll I had to take my word for it. And also, it was recently remade as Brick Mansions, Paul Walker's last movie, which also his sidekick in it is David Bell, but it's been like 12 years later, and I'm told it's been a really hard 12 years. He like looks significantly older. Anyway, District B13, good stuff. How about you, Greg?
Well, on my blogosphere last week, something came up that was tickled my fancy. It was HBO announced that they are developing a television adaptation of Margaret Atwood's Mad Adam trilogy to be produced by Darren Aronofsky, was it this year or last year? Did Noah?
This year.
This year. So continuing the sort of dystopian or post-apocalyptic, I don't know, continuing that theme in a weird way. So I'm pretty excited about that. The Mad Adam trilogy has made appearances on this podcast before. I know we have other fans.
Brian
in
recommended
the house.
It at some point.
On Greg's first podcast, he confronted me about whether or not some of the volumes in the trilogy were a prequel.
Contended that they were a simultaneum, I believe.
I believe that I contended that they were a simultaneum, and you contended that they were a prequel, and you subtly hinted that perhaps I had not read the final volume.
Do we need call security here?
If I recall.
This could be fun.
I admired your tenacity.
I think I was initially wrong, but I introduced the word simultaneum. So, yeah, these are pretty elaborate movies. I think it's going to take a minute for HBO to film them. So, in the meantime, I recommend you read these books so that we don't have ridiculous hold cues a la Game of Thrones in the future. Get started, people.
Okay, well, I want to mention briefly the latest book in the Harry Dresden series. I just finished reading it. It's called Skin Game. And for those of you who have been following along are kind of a little bit lukewarm on Harry. I will tell you that this book is kind of a return to Harry awesomeness. It kind of went through a phase where some weird things happened. It's a spoiler, so I don't want to wreck it for you. But now we've kind of come back on the other side of it. Everything has gotten, I don't say we put back in order. I mean, but this felt like an older Harry book. It was very good. It's funny that Mike just mentioned parkour because Harry has become a practitioner of parkour.
Ooh, exciting.
And it comes up about 6 or 7 times. Like, he's running away from bad guys, and he's practiced doing it. Like, he says parkour when he does it. Like, he jumps and parkour and jumps over something. And I kind of knew what it was, but I hadn't. So it was just funny that you just mentioned that because it's in this book all over the place. So if you were questioning Harry Dresden, feel free to come back to Skin Game. It was very good. Give yourself about 24 hours because you're not going to want to put it down once you start because it's kind of one of those. So parkour.
I'm just kind of plugging early. Movies at Maine. Come to the Movies at Maine Saturday, July 12th, 2014 at 2 p.m. Down here at the Nashville Public Library, 615 Church Street, to see Rod Steiger, Lee Remick, and George Segal in No Way to Treat a Lady. Rod Steiger plays a Broadway producer and literal lady killer in this dark comedy and underappreciated film from the 1960s. It was directed by Jack Smyke, based on a book by William Goldman. Sadly, Jack Smyke, the director, has passed away, but I was able to talk to his son for an interview, Alex Smyke, who is he's been with the original CSI from the very beginning team, started as a film editor and now produces and directs shows, talks about his father, this movie, and his own work on CSI. So this is just upcoming. Keep an eye out for the Legends of Film podcast, and just remember July 12th is where we're going to show No Way to Treat a Lady.
All right, I wanted to just give a shout-out to a book, that old-fashioned medium that I hear people sometimes still enjoy. It was this little short poetic memoir called Crapalachia by Scott McClanahan. And Mr. McClanahan grew up in West Virginia coal country, and this is his memoir about his experiences of what it was like. For a long time, he lived with his, you might say, like borderline psychotic grandmother and his uncle, who suffered from cerebral palsy. Crapalachia. I loved it. I read it for Second Wednesday Book Club, my book club here at the library, and it was really, really good.
Has he ever been at the library before, Brian?
Well, Greg, since
you were asking.
He was here at the library for Southern Festival of Books, and in my opinion, I think he was the sleeper hit of the Southern Festival of Books. I don't think people were ready for a sort of outlaw poetry aspect to a lot of his work and how much teeth it had. Though it was funny, he had a cold that day, but he still wanted to come down to do Southern Fest, and I'll link to that. It's on C-SPAN. You've been listening to the
Pop Medic Podcast.
Mm-hmm. You can get more information at
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
And make sure to give us a high rating on iTunes, because that makes us podcast superstars.
We'll be your friends.
Superstars. What you are. What you see. What you be. We'll put in the karaoke track later.